excuse me, I'm nervous, but you know, I think most of us students get a little nervous in the process of presenting. I wanted two extra pieces of material. One that I will pass around to you to share is a letter somebody sent me recently. And the other one I got off from a very dear friend's website that passed away recently, Siamani Blum. And I found that it is a Nigerian writer that spoke, and if you're interested in the link later on, we are happy to send it to you. And her name is Adichie. Adichie had a very interesting concept. And she spoke about the danger of one story. She talks about problems you have if you only hear one story of an ethnic group. You have the danger of hearing only part of it. And for example, that the media a lot of times portray only part of one story. So you tend to only, you don't get to know who the people really are behind the story. For example, a media coverage. So you might say, I didn't know they were poor whites. A lot of people say to me, how can you not know that they were poor whites? What is the, that, you know, where did this come from? There was a heading from my Guardian, and it was also in a couple of newspapers. The perception of who and what the Afrikaners is also shaped by the media. Whites was, for example, they say whites was, and still is financially looking a privilege. All Afrikaners are racist. Afrikaners hate black people, and so forth. And just let's look a little bit back into maybe a year ago, there was a media coverage about a Free State trio that was accused on campus of doing racist activities towards cleaning staff there. And this was also always, and also it was told to me, but I will never go to the Free State University because only they are all racist. It's only hearing one part of the story, and it's very dangerous. Did she say, all the stories make who I am? But to focus on negative stories is to flatten who I am and to overlook all the other stories that make me who I am. As an Afrikaner myself, I recognize that I'm shaped by different people. I'm shaped by different activities. I'm shaped by religion. But to see me only as one story is to stereotype me. Because I'm an Afrikaner, it's only to hear a single story. You only tend to hear a single story about me and my people. As Adichie said, I'm more than just a single story. I'm more than just the negative stories. And to hear only that is dangerous because you never understand who and what we are as Afrikaners. It is single stories which create stereotypes. But the problem with stereotypes is not only that they are untrue, but they are incomplete. Not that they are untrue, but they are incomplete. They only make one story become the only story. I asked the public, what did they think about Afrikaner Carbos? Yes, some of the responses. Carbos are stereotyped as work for black people. I'm always surprised when I see white Carbos. It doesn't seem normal. They must be very poor and very desperate. It's unacceptable. Because white people are perceived as rich people. It is declining the status of other whites. And another person said, as blacks do not think that white people can be that poor. And I think that they were rich and they got into a lot of debt. They couldn't pay their way out of trouble. I do not feel sorry for them. And white people are one, majority of black people are poor. I hear only one story, I am poor. Unacceptable to be poor. Damaging to other white status and fault of white people that black people or black people are poor or in the situation we are. Is that the story that we hear? The stories about apartheid on parochial schools, but I want the only schools to be good. And to understand the people, it is important to engage with all the schools. What damage did apartheid do to the white people? Because apartheid gave the Afrikaners a false sense of security. Those working in certain governmental situations, they actually did not see the need to complete their schooling. Now, in the new dispensation, they are left not only with a lack of education to secure work, but they're also in the private sector also. So they cannot find themselves jobs. Frans Brown, one of our participants, explained to me that he only had a standard 7, grade 9. And because he found a job on the railways, straight after leaving school, he never felt the urge or the need to further his education. Because he already had a job, he said. In reflection, the participants acknowledged that apartheid did more damage to them than the benefits, than the benefit of them in this regard. Now I told you, I gave you an introduction of the danger of hearing only one story. How do I get to hear the story of my participants? What is the procedures and what are the steps that I took? Right. The objective is I'm going to start restate the research problem for you. I'm going to discuss the research orientation that includes discursive analysis, the narrative inquiry interpretive approach. I'm going to talk about the sample group briefly, and the methods that I use, participant observation and loosely structured interviews. We look at ethics and the actual doing of the research. How do I gain access into the field, trying to blend in? Finding appropriate times and context in doing the research and reflecting on myself and the interviews. Self-reflexivity, I'm trying to be impartial. Focusing on the interview dynamics of it. I'm going to then restate about the research problem to bring me back to my focus. After 1994 lectures, everybody had to face those changes. And that is everybody that is white, black, everybody in South Africa. For some of these changes were positive, to others negative. This research looks at the identity structure of Afrikaner compounds in England. I want to know how did the Afrikaners adapt to these changes, and specifically the Afrikaner cargos in a segment of the of Afrikaners. Adaptation required more than attitudinal adjustments, and this is also very important. Identity construction of the Afrikaner has to be viewed from different discourses. Friedman argued that we are socialized into identities from the cradle to the grave. Construction of the South of Afrikaner is not only in childhood, but continues to shape us through our lives. There's many examples we can look at. The socialization process formed the social and personal identities of the Afrikaner. We could look at some of these examples as we go on. Okay. The research, we can just quickly going to look at two parts here, the discursive analysis and interpretive in the Afrikaner tongue struggle. All right. Where am I now? Start one. Yes. Discourses such as language, cultures, and policies inform social identities and are important points of departure on this investigation. First, they explains discourse as being a set of meanings, metaphors, representations, images, stories, statements, and so forth that in some way together produce a particular version of things. I wouldn't have to tell you as a room full of academics I didn't need to define discourse, but I want to highlight something out of it. I want to highlight that it is about the images, the stories, the representations that you need to have here more than just a single story of people. The research will be looking at what is good social identity through the discourses of race, the discourses of gender, and the historical discourses of apartheid. One can look at the Afrikaner identity through the discourse of race and exclude the discursive research of how apartheid affected us and the perspective of race. Discourses are interlinked and overlapping. You cannot isolate one without looking at the others. You need to research the how of the smaller parts to see the whole identity. Discursive methodology allows me to observe the interaction between the participants and between the participants and the public of different races. And through this interaction process, it's possible to see the participants and how they negotiate whiteness among in the fields, in where they work and among each other, others and amongst the others. The other broad approach that I used is the interpretive approach. Interpretive approach allows for the collection and interpretation of qualitative subjectivity. It relies on the participants' viewpoints to understand their own social reality. The researcher has to listen to the participants. Sometimes the listening process includes listening of body language. When a participant is reluctant to speak about it, they show it in the body language. Or very uncomfortable about the topic. Or if they responded to the extent that the emotions, they responded that the emotions override how they, the actions, they tend to show it in the body language. Often a participant would use a lot of energy in describing an event. And I've got an example here. One of the participants in the father's funeral, his father was in the military and they dragged the flag of the kids and the coffin, and basically the kids ripped the flag with the coffin and replaced it with the old flag. They had no feeling, they don't associate with the symbols of the new South Africa. And the way she explained it to me, the way that she spoke about it, showed that she felt very deeply regarding these symbols. For Stephen is to understand the perspectives of other people, and because understanding the situation, we need to look at the present, and we have to look at the Afrikaner's past. The mission, a lot of times you listen to what is left out. People sometimes say, they go around what they say, how they say it. And they don't really, they don't always have to tell you exactly the words, and they leave something out on purpose. And you have to be able to pick up and listen to it. The interpretive approach. The interpretive paradigm allows not only for interpretation, but also for participant observation. Participant observation gave me a vantage point, not only to understand the participants, but see firsthand how they experience the work situation. How do they experience other people? How do they negotiate the working space? And as I mentioned before, it allows me to see how the participants speak and interact with each other, how they interact with the public. And it also allowed me to build a level of trust, which is ongoing, because even today, I think I finished in October last year. I'm still in regular contact with some of my core participants. I keep on sharing their feelings about things, and I keep on sharing about their struggles, and also the interactions, the interactions in front with problematic customers in the field. I use narrative inquiry, a quantitative research tool, in the interpretive paragraph of Protestant translation. Narrative inquiry highlights experience and context that supported in the study of race and ethnicity. How do we understand? We need to understand how this is done. How do we understand this by listening? How do they construct the stories? How do they understand? So we don't only hear the one story, we need to hear the other stories. Narrative and cognitive process. They do not only tell stories. They construct meaningful relationships, absorbing the information, thinking about, and how do they put it out? How do they tell you the story? And I saw this a shift in the perspective during interviews due to the cognitive process. The shift can be perceived as participants contradicting each other, but actually it's not. We will discuss something, they will go, they will answer my question immediately, they'll go away, think about it, then they'll come back with a different answer. Now, in the beginning, I thought about it, I said, oh, wait a moment, there's something strange going on. They're contradicting themselves, but they're not. They're thinking about it. And like, for instance, Sorrel, one of the participants, said he resigned from his job in the realize because he could not share the vision box with black people. And later on, he came back to me and he said, but, you know, he made the decision to resign was because out of fear. He was scared. He did not know how to handle the new situation. They did not know how it's going to... How is it going to affect him in the long term? It was easy for me to resign from his job. Many argue that they are jobless because of the new government, but later on they come to me and they do acknowledge that no, the problem is not so much being jobless, it's because of the government, it's because of the lack of education. That put them into the current situation. I want to share with you a couple of our stories that did come out. And some of you that went to school during apartheid time would know, recognizing the stories and hear it. But it also came out in our interviews, that is why I'm glad to share it with you. Symbolism was utilized to promote apartheid and ideology. Stories of African heroes. This has been built into the curriculum of the schools. Robert Pierre, the little Afrikaner girl, that got lost. She and her little brother. She hollowed out a ant hill, took her clothes off, put it on her brother, and now it in front of her ant hill. And she died in the process. Rival Tomato. The 60-year-old man, he couldn't stand the screaming and shouting, crying of the dying seaman drowning because in Cape Point. He went in with his horse and rescued about 8 people of the common hero. And Piet. If you're not familiar with South African history, Piet negotiated with the Zulus rights to property, which is a long story, but he was murdered in the process of the Zulus, and he was being seen as a hero. Big of the constitution. Why do I use that narrative? Interesting. It's been two generations since. Sarah and Daniel, participants often refers to the Afrikaner heroes and others such as Future Teeth and the Anglo-Boer War heroes, and the historic implications have still have in our minds. Sarah often looked back at the Afrikaner history to point out how Afrikaners suffered at the hands of the English, thus indicating that hatred, British imperialism was still kept alive by some of the commoners, although they're two or three, sometimes three generations down the line. I received this letter I would like to share with you. I'm going to extend my seminar. You'll have to, if you can pass it along and share, please, those of you who are reading it out. There's something on that side. I received this letter and it starts. Although I do not fall within the social economic group you are researching, I'm a second generation post-World War Afrikaners. and feel that I can and would like to make a meaningful contribution to your research by contributing an insight into the effects of a bullet historic indoctrination, for the ones of a better term, if you will. I grew up on what perhaps best is described as the upper fringe of the white, poor white society. Because of financial constraint, I was obliged to leave school after grade 9 and seek employment to help support my family. Had my mother not instilled a sense of pride in us, focusing our aspirations on higher values, I might have also become a cowboy, have been a subject of the research. But as a result of example influence, I eventually went to earn a bachelor's degree in USA. I am not and never have been a radical Afrikaner. In fact, always moved on the outer fringes of the Afrikaner culture, but no other can truly relate to the trauma the Afrikaner suffered as a result of the World War. The scars that were left on Afrikaner's psyche is very deep and have never been resolved. Considering the size of the Afrikaner nation, the deaths of thousands of women and children in British concentration camps was of near Holocaust proportions, and would have been such had it not been for the intervention of Emmy Hobhouse, who at the chairman of the British field commander brought the plight of these peoples, the plight of these people to the attention of the British public. Whenever I visit the Froman Monument, or the Women's Monument in Bloemfontein, and walk between the rows of memorial plaques, each giving the location of the individual camps and the number of women and children who died there, I cannot but be moved by the enormity of the brutal injustice inflicted on my people, and I cannot but feel a spiritual affinity belonging to them. I must add that this affinity goes deeper than the events recorded in history books or political propaganda, but comes from first-hand testimony. My maternal grandmother was forcibly removed from her home by the black auxiliary mentality in her command of a British officer and their house, was just about all the possessions burned to the ground, and she and her children were taken away on an open ox wagon to be interred into his camps. Whilst on the spur of a moment, I mentioned this because it was not a pilgrimage, I'm driving past a turn off, I decided to visit Umgrovu. The site where Picture Tip and his party was masqueraded by Dungan. Here, I had one of the most eerie goosebumps experiences of my life. It almost was as though I could feel the presence of the spirits of these men who are such an important and integral part of the Afrikaner legacy. I believe that this historical event, perhaps more than any other, sowed the seed of Afrikaner black distrust that would later develop into full-blown racism. It must be added that this masquerade was followed up by the masquerade of the Voortrek Lagers at Vienna and Lokrans, where the defences were lowered in expectations of the successful signing. The point of all this, in terms of the research, is that the heroes of the past are a very real symbol of culture, but a symbol that cannot be understood or dissected in mere academic terms, especially not by others who do not have it in their blood. And it's almost as though their blood and their the blood of the concentration camp victims were sacrifices on the altar of nationhood. There's another copy of somebody. How somebody that is not part of my research, my sample group, has such deep feeling towards what my participants also relate to me.
Yeah, I think the power just meant that it wasn't turned on here. So it just has to restart again.
Okay. Sorry about that. That deep feeling it is the feeling of an unbelong, a feeling that I lost something during now post-apartheid, a feeling that the injustice, there's a certain amount of injustice done to the Afrikaner people, because we cannot express that feeling that we have. My sample group consisted of 17 participants, 5 women, 12 men, 12 men and double over the age of 40 years old. The reason why I chose 40 and old is because they grew up within the apartheid system. They were economic entities that worked during the apartheid, so the social identity was already confirmed. They would have been socialized by apartheid ideology and also, like for the previous example, would have experienced the symbolisms that we discussed. The methods I used. Participant observation and loosely structured interviews. I had to gain their trust and respect, and it was not so easy in the beginning. Initially, I thought that just being a rather common would make it easier to gain the participants' trust. But one of the participants told me, "I don't trust you. You can write anything and show it to the ANC, and they'll come and get me." However, for some participants, it took longer. The same third participant now is sharing with me a lot more than you used to share, and which I'm still bringing into my paper. My interviews were very conversational, allowing for privileged information. I find that one of the reasons that you talk, you exchange ideas more, you sit in a very semi formal situation where you can sit and discuss things and exchange ideas. And I found that I got more information through being going through a structured interview process, which I also did, semi-structured. We did have, initially, we'll sit down and get to know each other, I'll ask them the basic questions, and that exchange of information came through. Thereafter, I worked as a collaborator for those who actually don't know that. And through the time that we worked, we'll discuss things, I'll find out more about their ideas and observe how do they work, how do they relate to them. So I used different methods. Focus group was a little bit more problematic because I couldn't get the call with a very well structured, and they didn't have the same time off at the same time. So, and after hours, it was also very difficult for me. Although 3 weeks ago, they requested a focus group after my initial attempts, and that was after the Moon Refugee Debate. And they sat and they discussed quite a bit of information because of it and how it affected them. How did they feel? How did they feel threatened? And they felt very threatened because of the murder. I recorded most of the conversations. There is one or two that they refused me that I can record. I lost a bit of it because if you don't, I didn't take notes as we spoke because I find that it disrupts the conversation, the flow of conversation. And I found that that by not recording, you also lose more than just what they were saying. You lose how did they say it. You lose the pauses. You lose that specific feeling that goes with it. It was basically two recordings which they did not allow me to. Ethics. As a participant observation, and a researcher, all about concerning ethics. Ethics. I want to give you one example. One of the participants shared very, very personal information with me. And although I had a signed copy of to use the information, and he is being protected through not using his name and so forth, I felt that once it's in paper, and I want to give our participants a copy of the research initially, I did not want to harm him through seeing that his secret has been published. So after much lot of thinking about it and so forth, I decided not to publish his that specific information. the doing of the research, gaining access to the field was not too difficult. What it was, because a co-op basically work for themselves. All that they pay a site fee and there is a site owner, they still belong, they still work for themselves. I did approach the site manager and ask for permission to interview the co-ops out of courtesy, and it was never refused. And I also had, because all the site managers, if you want to call them like that, they were also Afrikaners, so I could interview them at the same time. Trying to blend in, I had to down dress, got myself a jacket. I had to basically also be a car guard, you know, downgrade my husband, try to be less. Clever at the using big words while we were busy working. Finding appropriate times and contexts was also do the interviews or the conversations. Initially, what happened is we went to the initial interviews, we went to school. Then I realized I bought them a snack, a coffee, and we'll sit and talk. And then I realized that it's not enough love of information. It seems that they only answer my questions as I go on. There is no discourse because they don't think about it. They don't reflect on the questions. As soon as we're outside and talk, you have that flow of information. And also during the break times, I found that if I go and sit where they were their usual break times, that it was more comfortable for them and they found them. Also, they said, we're not used to sitting in a restaurant. You know, it's this unfamiliar place for them to be and, you know, and being interviewed. Reflecting on myself and interviews. You took a corner to record my own thoughts also. Often the car got to walk away and help the client, I would record my feelings and my thoughts. That immediately for them also gave me immediate context from which I can also analyze the data. It also allows me to put down immediately my thoughts that that often are lost because you think about it and you don't try. I have to be impartial, and that becomes a little more difficult. As soon as I start talking about the other, and they describe the other as being dirty and unhygienic and this and that, I have to be impartial to it and allow them to tell me what their thoughts were without putting out what I believe. Also focusing on the interview dynamics, I steer the conversation and semi-directed on me. So as a conversation goes, I kept on steering it to make sure that I didn't get the information that I wanted. Before the interviews, I'll go over through my objectives before I start working. So I'm very clear in my mind that I don't go way off track. That can very easily happen in participant observation if you totally go off in a different direction. Finally, something else came into mind. I was busy with my proofreader. He said to me, you know what, Lillian? He said to me, just see that you like Afrikaans. I'm not going to call myself. You don't like Afrikaans. What is it? What's up? And it made me think about it a little bit of the law. What is it that he made that remark. What did he pick up that I didn't pick up? Is it, and I thought about it, it's because I think I rejected the Afrikaner mentality. My mother's family were very Afrikaner, and that Afrikaner mentality. The way they thought, the way they spoke, the way that they perceived a race. And because I rejected it, I basically moved away from that Afrikaner identity. But still, I am Afrikaner. I had to look at my past and see where do I, how did my identity, how was that informed? Being brought up in apartheid by myself, I had to go through the schooling system. My identity was informed by the stories and by the other symbolism, by the flag, by the anthem. All of these informed my identity. But even through everything, I tried to push it to one and say, listen, that's not who I am. So I had to think very carefully about it. I had also some difficulty adapting to the new South Africa. There are certain things, you know, adapting. Not a new anthem, but it's not my anthem. It's not our anthem. It's not our flag. I don't have that same feeling as participants. Also don't have that feeling of that it's our flag. It's something that was pulled away from us after 1994 elections. I also make believe that Nelson Mandela was a terrorist, that blacks did not appreciate the free schools in Burundi, that the army made men out of boys, the boy who saw the borders was our heroes. I wrote letters to them as a youngster. I saw the confusion. I'm a love pastor. I saw the confusion and how lost the Afrikaners were after 1994. I saw my family being lost. I could see the confusion around me. I saw the disbelief when the horrors of apartheid was revealed and heard my fellow Afrikaners speak up with the pastor. How the traps sold our country council. And we need to understand them. We need to understand Afrikaners. Not just to hear the one story, and also understand what the impact was of the fact that I had on them. Thank you.